Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the podcast for August 27th, 2007, and on this episode, we have an interview with Greg Kolak. He is the director of The Odd Couple, now playing at the Oakbrook Terrace Drury Lane Theater. Also on this episode, we have Chicago's theater news. So, get ready, Chicago. Let's talk theater.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our special guest this week is the director of a hit show, The Odd Couple, by Neil Simon, now showing at Oakbrook Terrace Drury Lane Theater. Our guest this week is Greg Kolak. Hello, Greg.
Hello.
Greg, I am so happy to have you on here, and I got to ask you, what can folks expect from The Odd Couple? Because believe it or not, at the opening night at the reception, there were a lot of young people there that said, gee, this is a good play. I never saw this before. Amazing as that may be.
Yeah, it is kind of funny that I've actually had a couple people say to me, you know, I've heard of it, but I've never seen it. I did see the TV show, or I see the TV show on MeTV or whatever it runs on these days. It's the story of two very, very good friends, complete opposites. One is the complete slob, the other is a complete neatnik, who Oscar is the slob, and he's been divorced for about 8 months and been living alone, and the apartment has completely turned into a shambles. And Felix, who is the neatnik, finds out from his wife the hard way that she wants out of the marriage, so he ends up moving in with Oscar. And, of course, because they're such opposites, things fall apart. And it's really funny the way Neil Simon has put it together, because it ends up being like both of them reliving their own marriages. And towards the end of the show, this, quote, marriage falls apart. And they start, Oscar's funniest line, I think, is that it's all over, Felix, the whole marriage, we're getting an annulment.
Yeah.
So it ends up, they pretty much just end up reliving their marriages, and they really didn't learn anything from their divorce.
Why do you think it still resonates today? Now, most of the opening night audience were older, you know, real hip theater people who have, you know, seen the movie that was a big hit and have seen several productions of it, and yet we all still laugh all the way through it. Why do you think this has such legs after 42 years?
Well, I think it's one of the funniest plays ever written. It's timeless. For one thing, again, like you said, it's 42 years old. It premiered on Broadway in 1965. And even though there are some references that date it, such as, you know, the Playboy Club and a couple prices and phone calls.
Actually, the prices produce kind of a laugh because of how high they are today.
Right, exactly. But other than that, you know, it's still timeless. It's like Arsenic and Old Lace is still funny after 60 years. You know, it's just something about it that it isn't dated, and it lasts forever. And
could be that he really tapped into human nature there, too.
Absolutely, he did. And it's not only with Oscar and Felix, but the other four poker buddies. The interesting thing is, I think a lot of people not only question, you know, why are Felix and Oscar friends in the first place, but they're so opposite. But one of the things that we dealt with in the rehearsals were, why are any of these six guys still friends? Because they're all so opposite. They essentially pick on each other the entire show, but they're still very, very close friends.
Well, I think one of the possibilities is, you know, they all came from the same grade school. That's kind of true in the Chicago area, and it's still in the neighborhood. You know, you grew up in the neighborhood, and somehow you get used to these people, and you are opposites. I mean, Northwest Side, where I grew up, we have a lot of people. We really don't have a lot in common, but we've just known them so long.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of a universal theme, don't you?
Yeah, well, and one of the other things, that was one of the things we talked about, that they all kind of grew up together in the same neighborhood, because they all are pretty near the same age. They're all early to mid-40s, the characters are. And another thing we came up with was possibly they all ended up in the service together at some point, because that would have put them all in the era of either World War II or the Korean War.
Yeah, that's true. That's another commonality.
So it's like, you know, when groups of people are in the service together, no matter what their background is, they sort of form a bond for life. And again, it's nothing that ever really comes out in the course of the play, but it was kind of fun for the cast to, you know, talk about why do these guys even like each other, let alone spend time together.
All right, let me ask you this. What attracted you to this play? Because I know you have a background, which we'll talk about later, of doing, you know, like dark dramas mm-hmm. and real heavy kind of work. And this is kind of a departure for you, isn't it? Got you attracted to this piece?
I've always loved the show. It's always been one of my favorite comedies. Drury Lane had actually chosen the show before they hired me, so I didn't really have a say in choosing the show. But as soon as I, you know, heard they were doing Odd Couple, I've been talking with Drury Lane for a couple of years now, probably longer than that, about directing out there. And then when I heard they were doing this, I contacted them right away, and things worked out with the dates and our schedules. It all worked out. But again, it's just funny. It's just a funny, funny show. I actually first did the show actually in 1974. I was a junior in high school. I had seen the movie, and I had actually at that time, I think I had already seen the play at some point in like 72 or 73. And a friend of mine and I performed a scene from The Odd Couple in our high school variety show. And after we had done the scene, we decided that we weren't satisfied with just doing the scene. We wanted to do the whole show. So we got about 8 friends together. We each threw in about $12 a piece, and we presented 3 productions in the summer of 1974 for a whole total budget of $120.
Fantastic.
And we got our high school theater teacher at the time, who was very happy to see that we were interested in theater and doing this in the summer. He somehow talked the school into letting us have the auditorium for nothing, and he claimed it was part of a summer theater program, which it was in a way, but it really wasn't connected with the school. So I've always, you know, for over 30 years, I've loved the show. It's always been one of my favorites. You know, it's like my Rocky Horror. You know, I can mouth the show word for word. I know
Why is it everybody in theater has that one or two shows?
Right.
And that's cool. That's great that you got a chance to do it.
Yep.
All right, give us the concept or the approach that you used in the show. You know, going in as a director, going into this, obviously you have cast people in mind, mm-hmm. but you have a point of view. Well, what was yours going into this?
Well, you know, I hate to simplify things, but my concept was do the words that Neil Simon wrote. You know, one of the things we talked early on about was the possibility of updating the show, of setting it in 2007, and thought about that for about 3 minutes, and then realized that was ridiculous.
Thank God you didn't do that.
Well, it becomes more than just changing references to how much a newspaper is or how much to that. And it starts getting into why can no one find Felix, because he would have a cell phone, and just the whole concept of the Pigeon Sisters, who are the girls that come over in the middle of the show for dinner at Oscar and Felix's apartment. They're so 60s that it would just totally, they probably wouldn't be funny if you tried to update them. Plus, it's just almost a visual joke when they enter.
Oh, it is.
In their mid-60s, hip and mod Carnaby Street wardrobe.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, I went early on, you know, I said, we're not going to reinvent the wheel here. And I hate to say, you know, do what people are expecting, but you kind of have to do Odd Couple as Neil Simon meant it to be. There's just, at some point, you just have to trust the playwright. I mean,
Well, it's only considered the greatest comedy ever written.
Exactly.
And he's
exactly.
You know, they said 100 years from now, or actually now, when they teach, you know, drama, they'll teach Shakespeare or Shaw. When they're teaching comedy, they teach Neil Simon.
Right, right, exactly. I mean, the man is, you know, considered by most people to be one of the greatest, well, first of all, one of the greatest living comedic playwrights, even though he has written, you know, like Lost in Yonkers is one of his more serious shows. But he is, and I think he will always be considered one of the greatest living comedic geniuses. The man started writing in the 50s in TV with Your Show of Shows. So,
yeah.
I mean, clearly And he was very young then. I believe he was in his early 20s when he started doing that.
Yeah, he schlepped coffee at the beginning, from what I understand.
You know. Right.
Yeah.
So we just decided, I just decided, and everyone, luckily everyone in the cast, you know, totally agreed and didn't fight the idea of just saying the words, trusting the words, and obviously you do things with character and you stage it and things like that, but ultimately it's all about what Neil Simon wrote, and that's what I stressed was, you don't have to work to be funny. Just let words come out of your mouth, and if you try to be funny, it won't be funny.
If you're in character,
situation
and in character,
so funny.
Yeah. Well, that's good. So you took a traditional approach and trusting of the material, and I think the actors respected the material, and they certainly understood the characters.
Oh, absolutely.
Each character had you know, and that's Neil Simon is underrated as a man who can develop characters. I mean, each one of these guys you remember,
and he's not. Is easy. His work is not as easy to do as some people would think. Some people would simply think, you know, well, he's so funny to begin with. All you have to do is, you know, no matter what, it's going to be a funny production. And I think no matter what, the lines are going to be funny. But there's a style. First of all, it's often said, and I agree, that comedy is harder to do than drama.
Oh, I agree.
Which I agree with.
Yeah.
And I think Neil Simon, it's, you know, doing Arsenic Old Lace, again, to go back to that analogy, and doing Neil Simon are two totally different types of comedy. You have to understand Neil Simon's rhythms. You have to understand the way he wrote. And one of the things we worked a lot with is that if you paraphrase even slightly in Neil Simon, the joke isn't as funny.
Yeah, I agree. And you got to have that little sharpness at the right time.
Right.
And those great one-liners, those comebacks. And
right.
Those one, yeah, I agree. Well, tell us about the casting, because brilliantly you have cast a stable of excellent character actors, none of them major names, although I knew a few of them, but they're not, you know, you didn't bring in, quote, big names to do it, and I think that worked, served the show very well.
Well, no role was precast. I mean, when we went into the audition process, there were some people I knew, you know, just personally that I wanted to see. I went through the files of Drury Lane, and, you know, their files reminded me of other people I had seen before, so it was a combination of inviting people in and just open auditions. And we had, I think, a couple of series of callbacks, and pretty much here we are. It's very interesting. Norm Boucher, who plays Oscar, I had originally came across him. I didn't know him well before the show, but I had directed him in a stage reading at Chicago Dramatists, and we had run into each other before. And I always thought he was a very good actor. And I had thought of him, and we called him in for I think it was Speed, who's one of the poker players. And he was reading, and then we, in the process, in the callbacks, we had called him back for Speed. And then Bill Osadek, who's the artistic director, leans over to me and said, well, what do you think about having Norm read for Murray, who's the policeman? I said, well, that's a good idea. So I had him read for Murray, and we really liked him as Murray, and we were very close to casting him, but we hadn't cast the whole thing, and we still were kind of up in the air what to do with Oscar. And Bill again says, "What would you think about having Norm read for Oscar?" And I said, "Well, your suggestion was good about having him read for Murray. I'll have him read for Oscar." And we brought him into the second series of callbacks, and he read for Oscar, and we pretty much cast Norm immediately after that.
That shows how terrific Norm is. He's such a good character. He could played most of the roles.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how did you cast the Felix? Because some people say, well, Felix is the show. I think all of them are the show. I mean,
yeah.
You know, they all play off one another, but certainly he's got a tough role. How did you cast that?
Well, Dan was just an open auditioner. He had worked at Drury Lane a few years ago. Ironically, he was in Arsenic and Old Lace, going back to that again. Sort of a recurring theme with Odd Couple is Arsenic and Old Lace. Pretty much the same process. We liked his initial audition. We called him back. We called him back a second time, and we cast him. So it was just, you know, the matter of, you know, he came to us and proved was funny to begin with and just got funnier and funnier, and the combination of him and Norm together worked very well in the audition process.
Well, what I thought, it's Dan Rodden, right? Is that how he said
it? Dan Rodden, yeah.
Rodden. How Dan was so good with the physical comedy.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't realize this show is not just the great lines, But the physicality and the facial movements and the timing of the body movements really adds a lot to the humor.
And it's a much different, again, going back into Drury Lane, which is a 1,000-seat house and a pretty big theater, is much different than acting, you know, in Drury Lane as opposed to, say, you know, the old Drury Lane in Evergreen Park where it was much more intimate, or even like Raven Theater, which is a much smaller theater. Mm-hmm. So to make that physicality work in a space as large as Drury Lane, although it is a 1,000-seat house, but for 1,000 seats, it really is fairly intimate.
Yes, you know, it is.
You're not as far from it. I mean, I feel like you can be in the back row of Drury Lane, and the back row of Drury Lane almost seems more intimate than the middle of the house at the Royal George. You know, for some reason, the Royal George seems much more cavernous, and Drury Lane doesn't have that feel to it. But still, because you're playing to 1,000 people there, doing the comedy and doing the physicality especially is an art, because you have to do it bigger than normal so it reads throughout the whole house, but at the same time you don't want to go over the top and you have to keep it realistic. So you're right, Dan does a really, really nice job with the comedy. He goes through all these contortions with his neck spasms and his sinuses clogging up and his,
he was just brilliant.
Back.
Yeah, he was just brilliant. And tell us about the supporting cast, too, because, again, the timing, particularly in those early scenes when they're wondering what happened to Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the bits you had, I mean, they run around all in units. It's almost like a dance routine.
Mm-hmm.
And then how they react when Felix comes in, I mean, I'm still seeing it. It's just hilarious.
Well, again, a lot of it is, you know, there in the script, but it's a matter of, you know, how you presented that makes it work. And we did spend a lot of time, you know, with the physicality. There's a lot of moments where the whole cast looks in unison. And that's a tricky thing, because you have to find the right amount of times to do some of those things. Because realistically, if somebody makes a comment, 4 people aren't going to look at them at the exact same time. But being a comedy, it works and you accept it. But you don't accept it if you do it too often. So,
but you do it enough, because Neil Simon is real good at repeating things, but his timing.
Right.
You kind of expect it, but you still laugh.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Now,
so,
did he put a lot of stage directions in the script, or was a lot of that, your invention?
Well, it's probably 50-50. You know, the chases are all in the script. Exactly where the chase goes, the whole bit of going into the bathroom and coming out the bedroom, that is actually written in the script.
Okay.
Which is a very funny moment, because
sure
I never realized, it's interesting how you don't realize as an actor or as a director, there are things you don't realize what is funny until you actually see it. And one of the biggest laughs is where they chase Felix and they go into the bathroom and out of the bedroom. And I always thought it was funny that they go in one door and out the other, but I didn't realize how funny it was that 6 guys all run into the bathroom and slam the door, because that actually gets the bigger laugh than the audience than the guys coming out of.
That's true.
Coming out of the bedroom. So it's just interesting. Even as a director, you don't realize what's funny until it's on its feet. But yeah, there's a lot of the staging is in the script. But again, a lot of the looks and takes and things like that are not in the script. And some of it came from me, some of it came from the actors. It's a very collaborative process, and I'm a very collaborative director, and I don't come from the school of, I'm the director, so you do it this way. I come from the school of, here's the way I want to do it, but if you have a better way to do it, show it to me, because we're all after the same thing. I'm not after every single moment is I own every single moment in the show.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because with such a talented group of character actors, you kind of got to let them do their thing.
Exactly, exactly.
And each one found the rhythm, found the quirkiness of the character.
Mm-hmm. And each, a lot of credit back to Neil, to Neil Simon. You know, a lot of their characters are obvious just from the lines. You know, you don't even have to, you know, as an actor always wants to delve into the characters and find the backstory in the characters, and it wasn't really that tough with this show, because they're so well defined on paper that,
right, and
you
then
know,
and
they're
then,
there.
And then
they're
you
there.
Dress them, and as soon as they walk in by their look and their body language, how they take their hat and coat off and sit down, I mean, before they've said anything, you kind of know a lot about them. which says a lot to the actors, too.
There's about three or four pages of dialogue in the poker game before Oscar even enters. By the time Oscar enters, you know each of those four poker players inside and out.
That's
just
true.
Just by the repetition of Vinny constantly looking at his watch and Speed with his wisecracks and Roy complaining about how much it smells in the place and Murray taking... I mean, the opening moment before any line is spoken, you know Murray because it takes him forever just to simply shuffle cards. So, you know, before a line is spoken, you know something about Murray.
Yeah, that's true. That's right. It's time for a little commercial for the show. It's The Odd Couple, the classic, still very funny comedy at Drury Lane, Oak Brook Terrace. And the show runs Wednesdays at 1:30, Thursdays at 1:30 and 8, Fridays at 8:30, Saturdays 5 and 8:30. Sundays 2 and 6 p.m., and you can go to the Drury Lane Oak Brook website for tickets. I'll tell you, it's not only a terrific show, but the ticket prices are moderate, $25 to $50, depending on what day and what performance. That's cheap today. Storefronts are up to $25, $30 now.
Yep.
So you are to be commended. This is a very, very funny show. And
thank you.
And I see the Jeff Committee made it a Jeff-recommended show.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, that's a feather in your cap because, you know, especially the shows that have been done a lot, it's, you know, they've seen these over and over again. So that says a lot. All right, tell us now some of your background. I know you were involved with Circle Theater for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us some of your credentials or your
background. Well, I've actually been working in theater for... about 30 years. I actually, right out of high school, I started working at the old Candlelight Dinner Playhouse just as on the staff there.
Another guy from there. My Polinsky, is there anyone in Chicago theater that didn't start with Bill Polinsky?
I don't know. Bill, I still see. I worked at Candlelight for over 20 years, and I was actually, I don't know if it's a, you know, if it's a famous or an infamous moment, but I was actually there to the bitter end, and I was actually one of the people who helped liquidate the business. I knew the building so well that when the business was closing, Bill and Tony essentially hired me to handle the closing of the building because they said I knew the building better than they did, and I would know how to...
What a sad moment that was.
Yeah, yeah, but... You know, life goes on. That's been 10 years now. It's 10 years this summer
that
it closed, and I have a hard time believing that I actually started working at Candlelight 30 years ago, but I did.
Okay.
But I worked there on the staff, and, you know, I essentially started working at Candlelight right out of high school, and I was considering very strongly going to college for theater, but then I got hired at Candlelight, and it became, well, I could either pay to learn or get paid to learn, so I took the obvious route, and that's the first thing people ask me is, where did you get your degree? And, you know, I'm certainly not going to knock college, but I never got a degree because I started working professionally in the business literally 9 months out of high school. And
well, you're a throwback to the old time. That's how people learn theater was an apprenticeship. They actually, from Shakespeare's day on.
Yep.
That's terrific. I have not met anyone else who has gotten to the level you're at that didn't have one or two college degrees.
Well, it's interesting, especially to, like, Dev Kennedy, who is in the show. Dev has been around Chicago theater for a long, long time, and Dev and I would have a lot of fun throwing out names of theaters that have been gone for 10 or 15 or 20 years that everyone in the cast would look at us and had never heard about them. You know, Stormfield Theater, Synergy Theater, Synergy Theater has been gone for about 20 years. So it's almost like a group of friends when you're, you know, 100 years old and all your friends are dead. It's sort of like, you know, I've been around for so long that I've known of so many theaters that most people have never even heard of before.
I heard of one you mentioned, the Synergy.
Yeah.
But I heard of it. I don't remember seeing any shows. Candlelight, though, I saw a lot of the shows.
Oh, yeah. Candlelight was around for about 40 years, but... But I just through Candlelight and people I started meeting, I started, you know, getting into acting, and through that I got into directing, and I directed my first show professionally now, I'm going to say almost 20 years ago. So I've been doing this. I think in 1989 I directed my first show professionally. So I've been doing it for quite a while, and it's just, you know, worked my way up through the ranks. I did my first show in Circle in 1994. And ended up being one of the three core artistic directors there when Karen Skinner left. I believe that was in 1997.
Tell us some of the shows you're proudest of that you've directed.
Well,
I stopped asking people their favorite because I know that's unfair. So one of the ones you're proudest of?
Well, one of the ones that I'm proudest of is A Piece of My Heart, which I did at Circle Theater in 1995 and ended up moving to Bailiwick the next year in 1996. It was a story. It was actually a show that I discovered just by coming across the script at Act One Bookstore, which unfortunately is defunct now too.
Yes.
But I had come across that script, and it's the story of women who had served in Vietnam. All true stories. I tend to be drawn to stories that are real, that are based on real events. And in some ways, people will say I'm most known for that. I'm most known for true event stories. And Piece of My Heart was a true story of...
Piece of My Heart. I remember that. It was a terrific show.
Yeah, it really was. It was a great script, and it was another show where I had a fantastic cast. And ended up, because it was a story that had not been told, a lot of stories had been told of men in Vietnam, but I was just drawn to it because it was a story of women who were in Vietnam, from nurses to Red Cross workers to USO entertainers. And it ended up being a pretty huge hit and winning several Jeff Awards, and got to know quite a few men and women who had served in Vietnam, of which to this day some of them are still my friends. So it was quite an experience to hear these people. We got to one of the women portrayed in the show came in from Oakland. She was began in the military in the 50s. And she's African-American. So besides being a female in the military in the 50s, plus being African-American, she was really way ahead of her time. And she actually predicted the Tet Offensive. She was an intelligence officer, and no one listened to her. So she literally could have prevented the Tet Offensive.
Isn't that amazing?
Which was the turning point of the war.
It was
the Tet Offensive that Walter Cronkite said, we cannot win this war because of the Tet Offensive. And that's when the public opinion of the war turned around, and
that's true.
President Johnson, again realized he could not be reelected president. So, and she could have prevented this. So, just a lot of my greatest experiences in theater and my proudest experiences in theater have to do with stepping outside of theater and meeting these people. And it really, that show brought out a lot of people who, because the homecoming for the people in Vietnam was not like it is today. I mean, they were spit on, they were ignored.
No, I lived through that era. A couple of my best friends had those experiences, yes, I know.
Yeah, and so it was a really tough time in American history, and we had a lot of Vietnam veterans who came forward after seeing the show and literally talked about their Vietnam experience for the first time after being silent about it for 25 or 30 years.
Shows you the major effect of theater.
Exactly.
Have you thought about reviving that show with all what's going on, and the parallels to what our situation now? It sounds like it would be worthy to remount that show.
Well, there's a difference between being a director and a producer, and if the opportunity arose again, I would certainly take the opportunity, but producing is much more work than directing is, and a much different type of work, and it's as much as I would love to do the show again, number one, it would be, I don't know that the experience would be the same for me, because I had such a phenomenal cast that I think I would never get those people out of my head, and it would be very unfair to try to force a different set of actors.
That's true. The age
doing
thing, yeah.
What these actors did 10, 12 years ago now, and most of those actors who were in that original production, a couple of them don't even live in Chicago anymore, and quite honestly, as a whole, they're all too old for the show now, yeah, because it was 12 years ago. So that's one of those things that if the opportunity arose, I would certainly take it again, but it's...
Well, that's a hint to some of the producers out there. I mean, really, the show had a major impact, and I don't you think it would work today?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I got to, a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago now, I did a production of Embedded at the Prop Theater, which was written by Tim Robbins, which was a pretty scathing attack on the Iraq War and on the current... the current administration, or the administration actually as it was, that sent us into Iraq. So we certainly got, that's a show I would love to revive, because that is still extremely current. So,
yes.
Anything that makes a comment on a political comment, I'm ready to sink my teeth into.
Okay.
So if the opportunity is out there, I'd certainly...
Well, that's
revisit
a strong
a piece
hint.
Of my heart.
Okay, Greg, tell us now, as the standard question I ask everybody, tell us where you want to be 5 years from now. So what are your future plans?
I just want to still be directing and be respected, you know, as a director. I would love to return to Drury Lane every year. It's been a great experience. I've been part of the Drury Lane family for 10 years doing other stuff. So
yeah, you did set design, a lot of set design work, right?
I didn't do too much. I did set design work much of a long, long time ago, like 20 years ago. I actually haven't done anything too recently, but what I did do at Drury Lane is I did, there's a few shows where they use like multimedia projections. That's what I've done for Drury Lane. Yeah. I've done a Vita twice, and I did a V-Icing a couple years ago.
Oh, yeah, that was a great production.
A V-Icing was a lot of fun. Very obscure show, but it was a lot of fun. But I just hope to be doing what I'm doing now, doing it well. You know, I think a lot of times the question comes up, you know, do you want to be famous? And the only reason that I would want to be famous is because it would help me continue to direct. You know, I want to be respected much more than I want to be famous. And anything that will keep me directing, I've been pretty lucky for the last 5 or so years. I've pretty much directed nonstop. I'm booked right now all the way through the end of January, and there's been times where I've been booked a year and a half solid with directing gigs, and I'm very
grateful
for that. There aren't a lot of people, you know, who can do that. You know, I don't want to compare myself to anyone, but I would love to be in a position of, say, like Gary Griffin, where he can turn stuff down because he has so many offers coming in.
Yeah, that's a nice position to be in.
That's a great position, is where you have to go, do I want to do this or do I want to do that? And, well, this offers me a lot more money, but this is more, you know, I guess, you know, this is a much more high-profile show, or this is a better show, and that would be a wonderful problem to have.
Yes, I'll tell you this. The Odd Couple has certainly made a lot of people stand up and realize that you can do more than just drama, that you can do comedy, and it's a major hit. And Greg, I really thank you for this interview. It's been great. And, folks, go see a play this week.
Hello, Chicago. Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you Chicago's theater news for the week of August 27th, 2007. Porchlight Music Theater will present Phantom by Arthur Kopit with music and lyrics by Maury Yeston. Phantom is the internationally acclaimed musical based on the 1910 novel The Phantom of the Opera. The musical, which is described as the most successful production never to have played Broadway, looks at the character of the Phantom from a different angle, answering questions such as where did the Phantom come from, why is he destined to haunt the opera, and what makes his relationship with the young soprano Christine the romance to end all. Porchlight's Phantom stars Laura Philipp as Christine, Naomi Landman as Carlotta, Jim Sherman as Gerard, and 2007 Jeff Citation winner Peter Oilo as The Phantom. Previews will begin on September 14th. The show opens on Sunday, September 16th, and runs through November at the Theater Building in Chicago. For more information on how you can get tickets to see Porchlight's Phantom, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's news section. Broadway in Chicago and the House Theater of Chicago have announced the next run of The Sparrow, one of the most original and acclaimed new works to emerge from the local Chicago theater scene in decades. The Sparrow will be returning to the stage by popular demand in a new production at the Apollo Theater starting on September 26th and running through the end of the year. The critically acclaimed The Sparrow first appeared on January 13th of this year at the Viaduct Theater, performing for 7 weeks to completely sold-out houses. The response inspired the Steppenwolf Theater Company to open its doors to the House Theater for a 6-week extension of the show. The show has set new box office records in both locations as the fastest-selling off-loop show. Production, of course, dominated the 2007 Joseph Jefferson citations and garnered 7 awards total, including Outstanding New Work, Production, Director, Ensemble, Original Music, and Choreography. For more information on how you can get tickets for the next flight of the Sparrow, click on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Coming Soon section. The House Theater of Chicago opens its 5th season with the world premiere of The Magnificents on September 13th. This original show is by company member and magician Dennis Watkins and being directed by Molly Brennan. The Magnificents is a magical clown show written by award-winning magician Dennis Watkins, who learned the art of magic from his grandfather, the one and only Ed Watkins. The show is a tribute to the late Ed Watkins and tells the provocative story about an ancient magician, his wife, and their quest to build a family. This show is just one of a few world premieres by the House Theater of Chicago for their 2007-2008 season. The world premiere of The Magnificents will be followed up by a world premiere of The Nutcracker on November 17th and The Attempters coming on March 14th of next year. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. We have come to the end of the news, but before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote comes from The Taming of the Shrew, Act 5, Scene 2. He that is giddy thinks the world turns round. Well, I can't thank you enough for listening to our podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with more news ready to stick in your ears. So, until next week, Chicago, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank Greg Kolak for giving us the honor of interviewing him this week. I would also like to thank Tom Williams and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And, most importantly, I would like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode, ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.